Welcome everyone once again to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific, brought to you by IEJ Media and sponsored by our generous sponsor, Bauer Group Asia. Much more about them in due course. I'm Ray Powell from California. That's Jim Caruso in Arizona. And Jim, we have a very special guest today.
We do. We have the founder, CEO, and president of Bauer Group Asia, our sponsor, Ernie Bauer. Ernie has been involved with Asia, especially Southeast Asia, since I was a pup. And I don't know what the hell he was, because we first met in 1997 when he was president of the U.S. ASEAN Business Council. And since then, he was headed up and started a Southeast Asia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and founded his firm, which is a consulting firm for the Indo-Pacific. Ernie, welcome. Good to see you.
Thanks, Jim. Great to see you guys. And I envy you being in California and Arizona. We got about 5 inches of snow outside.
You need some salt.
Just walked in from walking the
coast. All right. So there's a lot going on in the world of trade and economics in the Pacific included. So let's ask the first question. Why should we care about the new tariff policies that seem to be coming down the road? Why should Americans care about these things?
Yeah, I think Americans will feel an impact of these tariffs. The rest of the world, particularly Asia, is trying to understand what role America is going to play now in the global economy. And it's become very clear. President Trump said he would do these things in his first month in office. He is certainly following through on them. The world takes this seriously. I think even our allies in Asia, like Japan, Korea, the Philippines, Thailand, and the countries that are working very closely with us, should have mentioned Australia as well, but countries like India are seeing an America that is, in their view, sort of retreating into an America first approach. So they're prepared. They're preparing for the tariffs. They're preparing for a more transactional approach from the Americans. And this will have repercussions on Americans. I think most Americans will feel it in a rise in prices for things that they're putting on the dinner table and goods that they want to buy. And I think the Trump team feels like hopefully they will also experience a rise in job opportunities, particularly in the manufacturing sector in the United States. Whether that is to come, we'll see. But I think the rises in prices is something that's it's basically economic facts. I mean, our prices will rise here, and Americans will feel it, and they'll probably care.
Well, good morning, Ernie. I understand, this is not the first time that Trump has been president. This is not the first time that we've had tariffs on steel and aluminum. What has been in the past? What have we seen when you take something sort of as fundamental to manufacturing as steel and aluminum, you put tariffs on them? Have we been able to discern an effect on the American consumer? This is an Indo-Pacific podcast. Have Indo-Pacific countries sort of, when they've experienced this before, what has generally been the result of these tariffs in the past?
Yeah. Well, on steel, if you asked about steel and aluminum tariffs, so there's two main effects on our economy. One is that these help American steel and aluminum companies compete locally. So it will give them an advantage because they'll be inside of a tariff protected market. So they'll have a pricing advantage over foreign steel, and they should be able to, if these tariffs hold, they should be able to compete at better pricing. And if the tariffs remain long enough, they could make decisions on new investments to increase manufacturing in the United States. By the way, in terms of Asia's perspective, you asked about that. If these tariffs are long-term and if they're going to hold, then that might influence Asian steel and aluminum manufacturers to invest in the United States as well. But what we've seen before, when we put these tariffs up, this means that in the near term, American manufacturers who use steel and aluminum, and obviously those inputs are used in a lot of things like cars, motorcycles, electrical machinery. These are major areas in the United States that will increase the cost of people who make these things and either make them here in America or ship them into America. So expect the price of consumer goods, including things like cars, to cost more in the near term and for the medium term as well, the next 5 to 10 years.
How have you found American companies looking to export to Asia responding to the threat that these countries in Asia will slap reciprocal tariffs on U.S. products in return? Are they investing more in Asia to deal with this?
Yeah, they will. I mean, there's a big question, Jim. I just got back from Tokyo a couple days ago, and I've been in the rest, you know, traveling around the rest of Asia this month too, in an earlier trip. I think they will have to respond with tariffs of their own. In most cases, I think countries are looking at a new normal where you have to protect your own market and try to promote foreign investment in that market. This is terribly inefficient for American exporters and American companies that are trying to work around the world and take advantage of that competitive advantage that we have, because American companies have done well over the last three decades in terms of being a very competitive group of companies globally. But they will now have to decide on which markets to invest in and which markets to make in. And those, I think, investments will tend to go towards larger markets like Japan, like India, like Indonesia, or bigger countries in Southeast Asia, where you can, if you make inside the market, you can sell inside that market. And for now, Asian trade agreements like TPP, like the ASEAN Free Trade Agreement, will allow trade, and so you can access the whole most of Asia if you make in Asia. So this will cause companies to have different strategies for America and different strategies for Asia.
Let me just follow up. So what that implies is American companies will disinvest from the U.S. to invest within the free trade agreements over there to get under the tariff barriers that will be erected in the U.S. So net U.S. exports are going to suffer.
I think they will, yeah. I think there'll be two strategies. I've never seen, Jim, I've never seen American companies having to think this way, but we're all in the midst of understanding whether this is a new normal or this is a short-term period in a sort of a U.S. political cycle that will have big impact on economic cycles. If it's what they're thinking about is they're literally looking at America as if it's almost a foreign market, a big foreign market that's putting up tariffs. So you have to have a U.S. strategy, but you have to have rest of world strategy as well. But now these are, instead of working together as sort of a global approach, you have you're having to think about what's our U.S. plan, and then what's our plan for the rest of the world. And this is causing a lot of reworking of corporate strategies, and where companies are just in the midst of this and trying to understand what's real, what's going to be sustained, and then how to adapt to it.
So when we've heard about tariffs from Donald Trump and his senior officials, we hear a variety of different reasons that there are tariffs. You know, some are just tariffs are good. You know, tariffs help American manufacturing, or tariffs help American business. They help American workers, or, you know, tariffs are a negotiating tool, right? So, you know, we're going to put tariffs on you so that you do the thing that we want.
Yeah.
You know, whether you be Colombia or Panama or China and Mexico.
Right.
Or tariffs are a great way to raise revenue. So this leads to a lot of uncertainty, whether a given tariff is actually coming or if it's just sort of transient so that we can get something out of it. How do businesses react then to this level of uncertainty where tariffs are sort of dangled out there for periods of time and may or may not stick around for very long?
Yeah, I think business is understanding the following, Ray, that tariffs are being used in different ways by the Trump administration. So they are being used as a negotiating tactic, and Trump's negotiating tactics, I think business understands this, is to make a giant ask or a giant threat. And then the country he's dealing with has to deal from his starting point and come down so that, you know, for sure they're giving up something or they're going to make concessions. I think there's an element of that, and some tariffs are used that way. We've already seen that tool exercise with Mexico and Canada. In another instance, and I think this is, so these are different approaches to tariffs within the Trump team. I think Robert Lighthizer has clearly articulated an ideological commitment that tariffs are good. They are going to use tariffs. Some of these tariffs are not going away, even if you make concessions. So it's some of them are not a negotiating ploy. They are the way the Americans are going to operate. And these guys believe that tariffs will create a new era of investment in the United States, which will bring back manufacturing in the United States and create jobs here and enhance American competitiveness. But they haven't thought through, you know, what that means in terms of the globalization, right? But so there's two areas, I think, two main areas where the Trump team is using tariffs like that. And in terms of raising revenue, that's another part of their plan. They want to use the tariff revenues to raise to reduce the budget deficit. And so anytime tariffs get paid, that's also, I think, in Lighthizer and Trump's view, that's also a good thing.
Just digging into that a little bit, my math says prices go up, demand goes down. So
we'll see.
Tariff revenue will be what it is. Similarly, if you're an exporter, your exports and revenue will go down. Therefore, taxes you pay will go down. So I'm not sure those numbers can work.
Yeah, you know, Jim, I think we're going to see, right? But we know from history, and you know, as an economist, and you've studied this stuff, they don't usually work. And we've tried it before. You know, the United States has tried tariffs before, and they haven't worked. They've made us less competitive. And politically, after the prices rise, it's very hard for the people that have caused that situation to remain politically powerful and able to be reelected. So we'll see. But I think no one in Asia thinks Trump is kidding or bluffing. Everyone in Asia thinks these are real. They're coming. I think that's right. But you'll see, you know, Mr. Modi, the Prime Minister of India, is in town tomorrow. I think most Asian countries are trying to figure out what they can buy from the United States as concessions to try to reduce the impact of the direct impact of tariffs on their own economy and exports to the United States. So, for instance, I expect Mr. Modi to come with a basket of ideas to buy, you know, more U.S. energy and some other defense equipment and some other areas like that. So I think this will look good to the Trump team, that, you know, countries are coming with, you know, with ideas about what they can buy more of in the United States. But in the long run, this is a major change in the geopolitical structure of the planet. And to have the Americans go back to what a lot of our Asian colleagues view as a very strong threat in American history, this is viewed as isolationism, America pulling back, America first. And the response is going to be in Asia, you've already seen it, China dream, make in India. The Southeast Asian countries are starting to look at strategies and policies to promote themselves, and and promote their markets in countries that can, like Indonesia, and countries that can't, like Singapore and Malaysia, who are, you know, trade is well over 100% of GDP in those places. They are going to be the ones who get hit hardest by this.
Okay, so now, to be fair, this is, you know, it's not like the United States invented protectionism, right? We've been the champions of free markets for, you know, quite a long time, especially since World War II. And for, of course, you know, the part of the reason we're having this discussion is for a lot of Americans that hasn't worked out as well. And of course, it hasn't been reciprocated by everyone. And you mentioned, you know, two extremely large economies, China and India. I mean, don't those countries, you know, isn't there a place for tariffs in terms of, you know, leveling the playing field with countries like that?
I think so. I mean, tariffs are part of an economic toolkit. They are leverage. But Ray, I'd like to point out that the way tariffs are being used by the Trump administration are not the target. They don't seem to be targeted tariffs. There's going to be tariffs across the board, right? So there will be targeted tariffs as well. I think I don't doubt the fact that tariffs are an important tool in a trade toolkit, but the way they're being applied here and the maybe the rapidity and without study, at least initially, is pretty unnerving to companies in particular who are trying to understand the game and manage risk. So if the tariffs were studied, if they were being used with precision surgically, I think it'd be easier to plan and understand what's going on. But the fact of the rapidity of them coming out, some being used for negotiation tactics, some being used for sort of a long-term ideological approach to making the America economy, you know, great again. It's causing a lot of chaos right now. And it almost seems like that's part of the Trump strategy, although I can't myself understand what the value of that would be.
So a lot of the discussion is about reciprocity. Now, in Asia, we have free trade agreements with Australia and Singapore, where basically all goods are zero tariff. And yet, apparently, at least being considered to put tariffs on steel, aluminum from Australia.
Yeah.
We had free trade agreements with Canada and Mexico, which are ready to be trashed as well, apparently. So I guess the question geopolitically from your travels are what people are telling you is we can't believe anything the United States agrees to because it can be just thrown away in a second.
Yeah, we're clearly undercutting our reliability as an ally and a trading partner, Jim. And I think it's not as if the Trump team hasn't thought that through. They've got to be very well aware of that. But if you take an alliance, like a rock solid alliance, like our alliance with Japan, to be fair, they were very shaken by the Biden administration's decision to limit exports of gas, which, you know, one of the biggest things for Japan is energy security, right? Energy security in Japan is national security. And the fact that we, under Biden, halted energy LNG exports to Japan was shocking to them because it left them in a quandary, right? Are they going to have to depend on the Russians with whom they have border disputes over contested islands? Are they going to, you know, can they get enough energy from the Middle East or other places in the world? And now that Trump is back, he's opening the doors again to LNG imports. And I think Japan likes that, but they're learning lessons, right? They, the Indians, our other allies in Asia, are learning lessons that in this era, after, you know, periods of, you know, you think about it, there was the Cold War, then there was a period of U.S. unipolar power in the world. And now we're moving back to a more multipolar world where you have to figure out and how to protect yourself. And there, it's no longer a relationship with the United States that that's you can really depend on. And I think this is really important for you to understand. And I think this is what companies are trying to understand. You're going to see a lot more energy between countries that aren't the United States and aren't China. So the middle powers will I think, grow in importance here. They're going to start to work together more aggressively. And Asia and Africa, for instance, are working more together. They're sharing, their trade is increasing, investment is increasing. They are sharing regulatory models. And that's one reason why Bauer Group Asia decided to build on our huge presence in Asia. We have people on the ground in 28 countries. Now we have people on the ground in 5 countries in Africa, and we'll grow the Africa network to be the size of the network in Asia over the next 10 years. But this is the action now. It's between, some people like to call it South-South cooperation, but I like to call it sort of middle countries who aren't these great powers, who are trying to figure out how to depend on each other to build resilience and dependencies that won't won't depend on a continuity of American policy or Chinese policy for that matter, and give them different options. So we're entering a whole new world in this sense.
And so what, you know, when you talk about this new South-South cooperation, what are the industries that are sort of leading that transition? What industries are benefiting and moving quickly into this new world?
Yeah. Thanks, Ray. Tech can move fast. You know, it doesn't have to put things into the ground necessarily, although data centers are moving into East Africa from India and other places. Even American companies are building them there. So tech will lead. FinTech is moving fast, and finance will follow that very quickly. Energy is moving quickly. And things like, you know, people are thinking ahead about where they're going to source key inputs for their own manufacturing. So things like metals, critical minerals, these are areas that the rest of Asia is waking up and finding the Chinese are far ahead, for instance, in Africa. And so we're working closely with the Japanese, for instance, and the Australians in sort of a quad-like approach to Africa to find out, you know, where we can compete and should make sure that countries who are democracies and sort of rule of law based countries have access to these key inputs over time as equally or better than the Chinese do in places like Africa and Latin America for that matter.
Well, companies in, say, Southeast Asia have a limited amount of capital available. Are they going to have to decide whether they invest in new facilities in the U.S. to get under our tariff barriers or in Africa or other South-South investments, or is there enough to do both, or are they going to choose?
They're going to have to choose. And in the for the most part, they're going to have to choose. And I think I see a tendency to sort of forge new markets. I think the United States seems less predictable than it ever has before. I think more investment will happen in other Asian countries and in places like Africa. I think there'll be a big boom in intra-Asian investment over the next 5 years. I think there'll be a big boom in M&A. I see that coming. There's a lot.
Sorry, M&A.
That's merger and acquisition. So buying and selling companies to strengthen your hand. As the just think of this, Ray. The world is restructuring. There's new rules because the old system is being literally torn down right before our eyes. And so under these new rules, you have to think, if you're a corporate leader, about two things. One, if rules are changing, they're likely to continue to change for the next decade. And so you can build in core uncertainty. But what can you know? for sure? And what can you invest in that you think where there's some amount of control that you have into predicting change and riding out big changes? So there'd be a lot more investments at home in big countries like India, Japan, China. And I think you'll find other Asian countries, like the Jim asked about Southeast Asian companies. I think they're likely to look for investments in places like India and Japan. I'm seeing a lot of Taiwanese investment coming into Japan. It's a big part of our business now. We're working, helping Taiwanese companies, you know, sort of move some of their tech supply chains from China into Japan, into Southeast Asia. And some of them are coming, also putting some money into the United States too, which is, it sort of makes sense if the United States is going to be a giant market protected by tariffs.
And isn't that sort of part of the theory of the case, is that, you know, by putting on these tariffs, we're going to have these countries invest inside the United States, employ American workers, all of that?
Yeah. I mean, I think investment in the United States has skyrocketed. It skyrocketed under Biden because of the IRA.
Inflation Reduction Act.
Thank you. And, you know, that was the carrot. That was sort of a carrot approach. Now we're having the stick approach, the stick being tariffs.
Sorry. And just what was the relation between the Inflation Reduction Act and other countries investing in the United States?
Well, what Biden did was put billions of dollars, made billions of dollars available as incentives to invest in the United States. If you were investing in energy efficient or green energy sectors, and that drew a lot of investment in. Also in the semiconductor area, as you know, the Semiconductors Act provided a big incentive for the global top end global semiconductor companies to invest in the United States. And that saw massive new investment by particularly Taiwanese and some Japanese and Korean companies in the semiconductor supply chain in the United States as well.
So as we discuss more investment in the U.S., more manufacturing in the U.S., are you hearing any concern from your corporate clients that labor unemployment rate is, what, around 4% now? We're going to tighten up immigration so we can't bring in new workers from abroad. Aren't there enough workers to staff these new investment manufacturing facilities?
Yeah, I think it'll be a massive challenge. And at the same time, we seem to be cutting support for U.S. universities. So, you know, you asked about whether the math adds up, Jim. I don't know. I mean, I think there should be a massive investment in American skilling up if you're going to invest in enhancing U.S. or a return to U.S. manufacturing. And manufacturing isn't what it was. You know, when our parents, you know, were living in the boom days of the glow of the aftermath of World War II. Manufacturing now is high tech, and manufacturing in many areas is less people intensive. And I think you'll see a lot of that, the impact of tech and AI in that sense. So maybe there's some counting on that this will be less involve less jobs for people, but more investment, more capital investment in machinery and systems that can do the manufacturing. So maybe that will alleviate some of the pressure on the job market.
So you mentioned Taiwan beginning to move some of its operations or some of its manufacturing and such. Yeah. Are there countries or sectors, well, specifically countries, are there countries that could stand to kind of be winners in all of this? By being well positioned to take advantage of opportunities that this new regime might sort of force into being?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as I mentioned, I think it's countries that can grow their own manufacturing and investment and are less dependent on trade. So those are the big countries. They're countries like India, like Japan, in certain areas, but it's hard to say in totality, right? Because Japan is very dependent on things like imported energy. India is also very dependent on having access to energy. The Indians, for that reason, and others, historical reasons, have kept relations with Russia and Iran pretty open. And it's to the chagrin of American policymakers. But that's not going to change. In fact, you know, this kind of approach by America will deepen India's conviction, for instance, that they've done the right thing from an Indian perspective. Because countries are forced to think now, you know, how do I protect myself? How do I put Japan first? How do I put India first? How do I put Indonesia first? And they're going to play that calculus will be different in every country. And there's going to be new rules that American businesses and others are going to have to try to figure out as the countries adapt to the new geopolitical normal.
Let me change the subject just a little bit.
Sure.
The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act has been U.S. law for 50-odd years, prohibits U.S. companies from basically engaging corruption overseas or having others engage in corruption for them. President Trump announced this week that it puts U.S. companies at a competitive disadvantage, therefore will suspend enforcement of this law. What do you believe that analysis is correct, and how do you think American companies will respond?
I was shocked by that. I mean, I think, honestly, I don't know who he's getting his information from, but American companies, you know, the fact of the rule and the ironclad enforcement of foreign corrupt practices, I think actually made us more competitive because we knew, any American company knows, you can't play the games that others can play. I think most of the countries that we work in know that these rules are in place, and so they don't even ask American companies. That means that some projects that are being managed by governments that have corruption or corrupt officials, they don't look to the Americans for those opportunities. So we lose some business on that. But in my view, businesses built on corruption tend to be exposed, and they don't work. They cost a lot more. You basically have a business plan that has a big gap in it because corrupt money has to be paid to build these things. And I think one of the greatest advantages of American business is that we are not corrupt, so we don't waste money like that. And the partners that we work with know we don't. And so the projects we invest in are based on sound market principles, because that's the only way you can sustain investment and make money. So if you look at our competitiveness against the Chinese and say Southeast Asia or Africa, Chinese investment has skyrocketed of late, but it's using some of these tactics, you know. So it's very expensive investment. It's not market driven in all cases, and they are basically choosing investments that they think are strategic, and they're going after them and buying them. So they're paying more than they should. And I think we've seen some of this in the past. Eventually, this giant tsunami of Chinese investment has been good, I think, for Southeast Asia and Africa, or at least it's the injection of money was needed. But it's likely that a lot of these projects, infrastructure projects, and some of the other investments they've made in critical minerals or energy, those projects will be up for sale as China's economy continues to slow down, and they will not be able to afford to pay for projects that don't make market sense. So I think there'll be a lot of rationalization of those investments over the next 20 years. And American companies, if we could hold to our principles and a market-based approach, and I don't think any company is going to take President Trump at face value and change their policies about foreign corrupt practices. They will. I think every company that I'm talking to is making no changes in its policy in this area. I think most American companies will continue to follow these rules. knowing and thinking that, you know, this could get reversed. A new administration could come in and look for the companies that went ahead and used this opportunity to not follow the law. And I think the worst aspect of President Trump thinking out loud about this idea, about not enforcing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, is that it makes our partners who might want to ask Americans for bribery might think, well, they can ask now. And so we're gonna have spend a lot of our time, you know, unwinding this for the next 5 years based on what he's already said, even if he goes back on this.
Well, to end on a happier note, Ernie Bauer, what is Bauer Group Asia? How did it start? And you know, what do you do today, and why should people care about Bauer Group Asia?
Well, you know, I sort of built the company. I started it in 2004, so we're 21 years old. I built the company with the idea, it was a policy-based idea that economic integration in Asia is the best thing you could do for security, to promote security in Asia. And I believe that investing in one another's countries, trading with one another, learning about and respecting Asian cultures and having them have more connections to the United States was the best thing I could do as a person to promote peace and prosperity and deeper understanding between Americans and Asians. And I think that model emphasizes people and trust. And we've really built an incredible company around that idea. We're 21 years old. We have offices in 28 countries across Asia and 5 in Africa. We have 235 people working in those offices. And I see that number doubling in the next several years. It's a great business, and it's based on people and trust and building those things up over the years. So I think BGA matters because it demonstrates, I think, an important maxim that if we understand one another, we're less likely to fight one another. And if we understand each other, we can all make money and improve lives, our lives and the lives of our children and future generations by working together. So it's a labor of love, Ray. And it's a business that I own. I haven't sold the company. I'm not selling the company. So you can guess that Bauer Group Asia will be around in 3 decades with the name Bauer Group Asia.
And finally, what exactly is a senior advisor, and what makes Jim such a great one?
Don't answer that, Ernie.
Jim, you know, Jim's a senior advisor because he had to come home from Singapore where he's running our business, and I would have loved to have Jim full time. But when you can't have a guy like Jim full time, you find another title for him. And senior advisor is pretty darn good. Somebody like Jim Caruso, who spent a lot of his career in Asia and Southeast Asia, he always had a great reputation for working with companies, working with Asian stakeholders. Really smart, an investment banker who decided to invest his life in government service and serving the country. I just always loved Jim's approach when he was in government. He's highly ethical, really smart, business savvy, and when you find people like that, you try to keep them close. And in our case, having Jim on the team has been.
Ray hasn't seen any of those qualities, so thank you, Ray.
Yeah, thanks for filling me in. Now I know what I'm missing.
Yeah, well, we'll try to recruit you as well, Ray. You're one of those people as well. I know.
All right, well, Ernie Bauer, we do thank you for joining us today, and we hope that you'll come back on.
I would love to keep doing the good work. Thank you.
All right, Jim. So we ended up with that discussion about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Actually, I was pretty surprised to hear about that. I always, you know, again, I am not a businessman. I've never been really involved in that sector at all. But it's always been my impression that American businesses really like the fact that they don't have to worry about the, you know, about when the foreign official comes to you and wants a bribe, it's easy. Sorry, I don't want to go to jail, right? You know, I don't want to lose my business. I always thought that they kind of liked the fact that they were protected by the law.
That is absolutely correct in my experience. I was in the economic teams in places like Indonesia, which aren't exactly known for transparency. The American executives simply would tell their bribe-seeking officials, I'm sorry, I'm not going to jail for you, and my company won't allow me to because they'll be punished also. So I can't. Now let's negotiate.
Yeah.
As Ernie indicated, well, let me just one other aspect. If you're a foreign official and you're giving out a contract and you give it to an American company, that means it'd be very difficult to accuse you of getting a bribe for letting the contract. So you're actually insulating them as well.
Yeah.
So it really, I believe, was a competitive advantage for American companies, as Ernie indicated.
Now, I could see, I mean, I definitely experienced on the arms side that there were times when, say, the Russians would get, agreements because they could make a very simple contract, right? You know, and basically very cheap, a little bit of extra on the side. Everybody, the corrupt foreign officials, the corrupt Russian officials, everybody gets paid. Everybody's happy, and the equipment was crap. And if they needed it fixed, then there were subsequent charges and more payments. And so I guess in that sense, some U.S. companies were disadvantaged, but it wasn't all just because of corruption. It was also because, Russia sort of structured their whole arms market around selling things as cheaply as possible. The foreign countries in many cases didn't actually care that much about how well it worked, because what they wanted was they wanted the shiny new thing on the ramp that they could say that we now have this capability.
No, absolutely correct. And this goes into our overall approach in these countries, where for years we're saying to countries, partner with the U.S. for your development. We may be more expensive, it may be slower, but we have a better outcome, both in terms of not corrupting your officials and having a project that has been seen to have social impact analysis, environmental impact analysis, technology transfer, and we will help you get there. Now, that seems to be going away, but China's still there. So are we losing the competition on all sorts of fronts, is my question.
Yeah, well, cheer me up. Tell me a story.
Well, I don't have to cheer you up, but I'll tell you a story. So I was giving a speech at a university in this Eastern Indonesia, a few hundred students. And I was talking about economics and doing business with American companies, that sort of thing. Then I took questions. And one question was, why is Indonesia so corrupt? So I said, well, look, it's because people accept it, basically. You're asked for a bribe, or you offer the bribe even without being asked because it's expected. So you have to change the paradigm. And one way you might want to do it is the way they do it in India, where they have a website called ipaidabribe.com, which is a great name, where if some official asked for a bribe at the driver's license office or wherever, you would take a picture of the guy and post it on the website. Wow. So I explained that, and the reaction from the audience was outrageous laughter. Because what they said was, no, you don't understand. We'll never get our driver's licenses that way.
That's kind of been experienced, around the region, right? It's when bribery is commonplace, it's the grease that oils the gears, right? It's actually what makes the system as it is work, because the system is so used to bribery that it just doesn't work without the bribe.
I was talking to an Indonesian cop who accidentally asked me for a fee instead of a ticket. And I said, well, why do you have to do this? Well, So, oh, you don't understand. If I didn't ask for bribes, because we share all the money we take with our group. Oh. So if I don't get my share, I'm letting down the group. And, you know, our salaries are really, really low. So it's actually baked into the salary structure.
Yep.
So yeah. It is a problem.
Sort of like when you pay your restaurant workers the minimum because, you know, they're going to get tips. You know, it's sort of the bribes are the tips of the government workers.
So next time my waiter comes for a tip, I'll say, so I don't get you bribes. And I'll mention your name.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jim, thank you for that. And thank you to Ian Ellis Jones, our producer and the founder and CEO of IEJ Media. Please follow him on his X page at Ian Ellis Jones or on LinkedIn. If you enjoyed this episode, hit the subscribe button. That helps us out. By the way, Jim, I think I saw today that we just passed 12,000 subscribers. You should subscribe because you want to hear more content like we had today. You can also, of course, get us on all of your streaming services, wherever you like to listen to your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. Follow us on LinkedIn. Follow us on X. Email us IndoPacificPodcast@gmail.com with any sort of questions or suggestions. And of course, we do thank our sponsor, BauerGroupAsia.com, which is where you can follow them and learn more about what they provide. For Jim and Ian, I'm Ray, and thanks again for joining us on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?